Good morning and welcome, and what an auspicious welcome that is for Ask the Pastor, as our most dear friend, Pastor Emeritus Frederick Bowie, joins us as only he can.
I was trying to play Merrily We Roll Along, but
You are giving Gabriel a run for his money, I tell you.
According to tradition, the instrument that was used for the last sound was not a trumpet, but a trombone.
Really?
Yeah. Well, a trombone.
And you were a man known for his love of the banjo, right?
I love the banjo.
Do you?
I do. I love the banjo because it's so loud it drowns out any mistakes that I make as a guitar player. Yeah.
So how have you been? You had a delightful Christmas, I hope.
I did. I had a wonderful Christmas. My father-in-law came up from Alabama, and we just had the kids. All my kids are grown. My son, Rick, who's 29, living in New York City, he came home for a nice break. And everybody in Christmas time, in times past, it seems like kids were always running off to a party and going that way, with their friends. But we had plenty of firewood, and I'd make a fire in the evening, and we'd just sit around and visit and crack jokes and watch funny movies and things like that. It was just a wonderful time, and but a productive time as well, as we were talking before the show, because when my children were little, I would make up stories like lots of parents do, and my kids just kept begging me to write those stories down. And, of course, I'd half forgotten them, so I had to sort of reinvent and rewrite them.
Sure.
And having started my own publishing company, Pergola Press, you got a little grape arbor in the backyard. It's called a pergola. It's where I do my daydreaming and think up crazy ideas for books. I had everything ready to go out to, I've got a book designer and a printer and everything. So for Christmas presents, all the kids got a copy of Uncle Fritz stories, which I brought a copy of with me here. But Uncle Fritz was the kind of persona that I created in which, as they say in creative writing school, I found my narrative voice.
You want to read one of those stories?
Yeah. Let me read
it. That would be delightful. I'd be ever so grateful.
Sure. This is one called Witchy Witchy, and is a version of a story, actually, that an uncle of mine on my mother's side, Uncle Rudy Hofstetter, used to tell. But this is kind of really my own version of the story. It's quite short, but here we go. Many years ago, in the hills of old Missouri, on the edge of a deep forest, there was a little cabin. And in this cabin lived a family. The father was a sturdy woodchopper, and the mother was a pretty little milkmaid. This couple had two children. The little boy's name was Ishkabibble, and the little girl's name was Yodelyoli. And they were the rottenest little stinkers that ever lived on the face of God's green earth. For example, all Ishkabibble ever did was lay around eating candy and playing video games. When his mother called him to dinner, he would say, if he said anything at all, "I'm coming, just let me finish this level." 2 hours later, he would wander into the kitchen, look at the good, nutritious food on his plate, and say, "Ew," and go back to his candy and games. Yodelyoli, his sister, if possible, was even worse. All she ever did was lay around eating candy and reading trashy magazines full of trashy, glamorous rock stars and movie stars, with her heart full of resentment that she was only 8 years old and living in the forest, and not 19 or 20 and living in Hollywood and driving a Ferrari. And of course, neither of these children ever lifted a finger to help their mother around the house, nor did they eat their spinach, nor did they hoe the garden, nor did they read their Bible, nor did they say their prayers. Finally, their mother couldn't stand it anymore and swatted both of them on the behind with their broom and drove them out of the house, saying, "Beat it, both of you. Go play outside, get some physical exercise, and don't come back till supper time." So, dragging their feet with every step and grumbling with every breath, outside they went, squinting their eyes at the unaccustomed sunlight and coughing as their lungs filled with the rich, pine-scented, fresh mountain air. For a long time they moped around listlessly, thinking only of the tawdry joys they had left behind. Then it so happened that they wandered close to the edge of the forest. There on the gnarled trunk of an old tree they saw a sign. The sign was black with drippy red letters like blood. It said, "Warning, enchanted forest, children, keep out." And the initials WW were signed at the end of the sign. Well, naturally, being the snotty little brats that they were, they went right in, first checking to see if their mother was looking, but they needn't have worried, for she was down on her hands and knees, scrubbing the kitchen floor. Farther and farther they went into the enchanted forest. The farther they went, the spookier it became. The trees were all gnarly and twisted and seemed to grab at them as they passed. Soon the high branches shut out all sunlight and they were in deep gloom. However, as they walked along the path, they found berry bushes. Trying a sample, they found that they were not berries at all, but the most wonderful gumdrops. This drove them on and on until they began to see a dim light far ahead. Now they were running, for the gumdrops had made them terribly hungry. They ran and ran and ran, then suddenly stopped. There was a mailbox right there in the middle of the forest, and on the black mailbox were two red letters, WW. They were so filled with cravings for candy that they didn't connect the WW here with the WW on the sign at the head of the trail. "Oh, boy," said Ishkabibble, "this is where Willy Wonka lives. Now we'll have all the candy we want." "You moron," said his sister Yodelyoli. "You don't know anything. WW stands for Wonder Woman. She'll treat us like royalty, especially me, because I'm a girl and I'm special." "You are stupid, stupid, stupid," replied her brother. "I just figured it out. WW stands for Worldwide Wrestling. All those big tough guys will be in there, and no girls allowed. Ha, 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 ha." At this, Yodelyoli began to cry. But from not far off came the kindest, most grandmotherly voice you ever heard. "Don't cry, my dear. Come a little farther up the path and let a lonely old lady fix you a nice treat." Just then, a little old lady in a threadbare house dress and an apron popped out from behind a tree. She smiled and took the children by the hand and led them down the path to her house. With every step, the smell of good things to eat, namely candy and cookies, became stronger. Then they saw the house, and what a house it was. The roof was shingled with gumdrops of every color and flavor. The walls were made of fresh gingerbread. The windows were clear sugar candy. You could see right through. The posts on the porch were giant candy canes. The woodwork was milk chocolate imported from Switzerland. The faucets ran soda pop on the cold side and hot cocoa on the hot side, with a basket of big fat marshmallows instead of bars of soap, for you never had to wash up at this house. There was a boys' playroom full of gruesome video games and evil-looking magic cards and stacks of guy stuff action movies on DVD full of car chases and explosions and no mushy stuff. Each one with the exact same plot as the one before, and an enormous flat-screen TV to watch them on. The girls' playroom had every Barbie there ever was, with every accessory ever made, plus every copy of People, Glamour, and Self, along with stacks and stacks of mush date movies featuring pathetic but impossibly beautiful girls whose man done her wrong, each one with the exact same plot as the one before, an enormous flat-screen TV to watch them on, except for the ones with the ugly duckling plot or the I'm going to be a star someday plot. "Now you just make yourselves comfy, my dears," said the little old lady, "while I stoke up the oven and make something yummy to eat." Little did the children guess her true identity, for they were bedazzled by the sweets, treats, and eats. Do you know who she really was? That's right. Who was she, Roland?
The Wicked Witch.
It was Witchy Witchy. That's where the WW came from.
Yeah, well, I was close.
And why was she heating the oven? She was going to cook the children and eat them herself. So the children sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. They ate gumdrops from the roof and chocolate from the woodwork and the candy canes that held up the porch and most of the gingerbread-bearing walls. They ate so much, in fact, in the course of a single day, they came round as pumpkins and weighed 300 pounds apiece. Meanwhile, Witchy Witchy had run out of firewood. Her servant, Igor, had spent the day at the moonshine still with old John Barleycorn, a-sippin' corn liquor, a-playin' the banjo, and a-smokin' his old corn cob pipe. That's in the next story. But we don't have time for that today. Anyway, when he finally showed up, Witchy Witchy was so mad she turned him into a toad and a-throwed him in the crick. By then she had to go gather firewood herself, so she was not a happy camper. And by now the house was in tatters with big holes everywhere. The children had eaten so much, the walls trembled with every step. "Look at you, you stupid little brats," said Witchy Witchy. "You have literally eaten me out of house and home. Now come here and build up this fire, for I am now going to cook you and eat you up." "Wah, wah, wah," cried Yodely Oly. "Wah, wah, wah," cried Ishka Bibble. And they both began to jump up and down in panic. "Stop, stop," cried Witchy Witchy in alarm. "The house is shaking to bits." But the children jumped up and down all the harder, and all of a sudden the house came crashing down on Witchy Witchy and killed her dead as a doornail, and the fire from the oven caught the house on fire and burned it all up so that it looked like a big marshmallow that she left in the flames too long. Meanwhile, Ishka Bibble and Yodely Oly ran as fast as they could. They ran away, and they ran so hard and so fast that all the candy fat melted away, and they were their normal size when they got home. As they burst in the door, Ishka Bibble said, "Hi, Mom, I'm hungry. Got any spinach?" And Yodely Oly said, "Here, Mom, go put your feet up. I'll finish scrubbing the floor." With that, their mother, the pretty little milkmaid, fainted dead away right then and there. And when their father, the sturdy woodchopper, came home from a hard day's work chopping sturdy wood and found the children singing and fixing dinner, he too fainted dead away right there and then, right next to his wife. But when they came to, they found the table all set and a nice bowl of chicken and dumplings set out for them. After dinner, they said their prayers, and the father said, "How about some dessert?" And the children fainted dead away right there and then. But when they woke up, They all lived happily ever after, and that's the way it was many years ago in the hills of old Missouri.
That's a wonderful tale. That's a wonderful tale. That's Pastor Emeritus Fred Bowie. You can find that at Pergola Press. Your website is?
Yes, www.pergolapress.com.
The folks in Branson ought to be calling you. There's a little place down there where you would you'd fit in just perfect telling tales like that. Don't you think?
Well, maybe so. I've never been to Branson. I sure would like to go someday.
Now, where were you raised? What part of the country do you hail from?
Originally? I was born in St. Louis at the old Lutheran Hospital on Jefferson, Miami. My mother was a nurse and had graduated from Lutheran Hospital School of Nursing. But my dad moved the family. My dad was from St. Louis, and Mom was from Perryville, but after they married and Dad finished his schooling in mortuary science, they moved out to St. Charles. And that's where I grew up. My dad was working for his brother, Art, who started the Bowie Funeral Home back there. And so that's where I grew up.
I'm just wondering where you picked up that country sound to the way you tell tales.
Well, I was active in theater in high school. And, performing and telling stories and finding different voices for the characters is just, it's nothing that I studied in college or anything, although I've been was formerly active in high school and college in theater. Years of preaching and reading scripture and trying not to do it in a monotone, but to put some just a little bit of inflection to bring the text of scripture to life.
It engages the attention too.
It engages the attention. Yeah. I once saw a Johnny Carson show years ago in which I had Charlton Heston was on, and Johnny Carson handed him the owner's manual for the current Chevrolet Impala and asked him to read a paragraph. And it sounded like the voice of God saying, "Be sure to change the oil every 3 months." It just was extraordinary. The voice is the greatest of all instruments. I mean, you heard my bleeps and blats like a dying cow, and my new little toy, my baritone horn that I bought off the wall of a bar that St. Charles was going out of business. Got it for $50. It sounds like a $2 horn, but the voice is created by God, and the word and words have significance and meaning, and when you speak them, I like to quote Pastor Kevin Golden, my pastor at Village Lutheran Church in Ladue. He says the word creates the reality. Until I was speaking about the word of God. And, even in normal human relationships, my wife and I were talking last night, the old idea of throwing golden bricks at people and saying, "Roland, you do a really good job as a radio announcer, you do have a way of drawing people out and finding out what's inside their heart and broadcasting that out to the vast audience of 35 little old ladies who are listening to KFUO at this hour." So that's a golden brick. But what I just said, I meant sincerely. But
thank you.
The times that people have said something encouraging to me, they're like a needle pointed in gold, and I'm hung in a frame on my heart. Words of encouragement like that.
Well, that's why it's nice to take some time when you come into the program to just do some fun stuff. Tell stories, listen to some music.
Yeah.
Because this is one of the good gifts that God has also given us. It's not all about high theology and churchly things and this terrible culture in which we live. It's nice to know there are still good things out there that we can find.
There are good things.
Yeah.
There are many good things. And if I can put in a plug, you know, in addition to the Uncle Fritz stories, I've, you know, got other books. I'm going to be on Book Talk later this week with Rod talking about my book on creation. I've got a novel that just came out. I've got another one in the works, a baseball
novel. We've talked a little bit about
novel.
That.
I'm working with a comedian who's looking for funny stuff. I write comedy songs. I wrote a new, I've got original songs that I've written, and I have a performance coming up at Picasso's Coffee House in St. Charles this Friday.
Where is that in St. Charles? You mentioned that last time. I didn't ask for the address.
Yeah, Picasso's Coffee House is right on Jefferson and Main in the old downtown part of St. Louis at the bottom of. Just keep going down the hill.
Oh, yeah.
And you'll find it right at the corner of Jefferson.
I know where that is. I went to college at Lindenwood.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah, sure, yeah. Sure,
so
sure.
I know my old town, you know, St. Charles a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, it's a very nice place, good venue, and so I'll be playing all kinds of stuff, including original songs there. And I've got a couple of characters that are probably going to visit me, the Reverend Blind Missouri Fishbone, who's an old blues man. He's a Delta blues man, but he lives on the Missouri Delta, you know, out there in a little shack. And also Professor Heinrich von Schumpfenhausen, who's the world's greatest music conductor. And he's going to make an appearance, too.
Now, do you do this on your own, or do you have backup musicians?
I do solo.
Solo.
Yeah, unless I can, you know, drag.
So it's kind of a small, intimate setting.
Yeah. Drag a few of my friends along.
So what do you play? You play the fiddle when you're there? You play the guitar?
Play the guitar, mm-hmm. And a little blues harmonica and some other things.
Now, another aspect that you and I share in common is we enjoy a little bit of pipe smoking every now and again. How are the good folks in St. Charles about that? Can I bring my pipe when I want to come and listen to you?
It's not a smoking. It's like most places. But, you know, Picasso's is not. But it's interesting that an anti-smoking ban was passed in St. Charles County by the voters. I think the county commissioner or St. Charles decided not to enforce it because, you know, if people want to have a smoke, go to a bar and, you know, have a smoke or a cigar, you know, they should feel free to do so. And people that object to the smoke, there's plenty of non-smoking places to go to.
Sure.
But Picasso's is a non-smoking place. So, Roland, we're just going to have to get together. As soon as the weather warms up, come over to the Pergola and we'll have a smoke.
Well, there's a big show coming up in February, too.
Yes, the Pipe Show.
Yeah, we'll have to look into that. Now, of course, you know, there's some others out there shaking their finger at the radio going, you should not be teaching our children such things. Well, like I said, there's still good things out there.
And the other thing I wanted to mention is, along with my writing, and a very good thing to this coming Sunday, the 20th, is a Life Sunday special service at Village Lutheran Church in Ladue on Clayton Road, combined choirs of Village and Reformation Lutheran Church. But I wrote a hymn text for this service. Based on the Coventry Carol, you know, da-da-da-dee-da-dee-da-dum. And David Berger is going to be a soloist along with my wife, Jean. It's a kind of a dialogue back and forth.
We'll talk a little bit more about that when we get back from this break. The pastor that we know and love for the music and the tall tales and just the great gemütlichkeit he brings into the studio with him every time he comes, Pastor Emeritus Frederick Bowie is with us. You can join us, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And don't forget the email, kfuo@kfuo.org. We'll be right back. Stick around. You've got no reason to go anywhere else. Good morning. Welcome back. It's the Ask the Pastor program on the Messenger of Good News Worldwide, KFUO. Pastor Emeritus Frederick Bowie, we call him Pastor Fritz Bowie, joins me here in studio. You heard one of the great tales from, what's the book again, sir?
The book is Uncle Fritz Stories.
Uncle Fritz Stories. And if you're looking for a good set of, we are not, we used to be, I was telling you during the break, Pastor, that my grandmother, my mother's mother, was the storyteller in my family,
yep.
And she was always so good about crafting these morality tales on the fly when my sister and I would get out of line. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I remember a certain terrible thing that would happen to me in a wheelbarrow if I didn't shape up one day. That's what you brought back to mind. You just don't find stories like that very commonly anymore. And if you're looking for some good old-fashioned stories where the kids can sit around and you can tell them and talk about what it means and how it applies to the greater world beyond, you can find this at pergolapress.com.
P-E-R-G-O-L-A, Pergola Press.
And yeah. Stay tuned, because later this week, Pastor Rod Zwanitzer, who's our managing director, who has the Book Talk program here, we'll be interviewing Pastor Bowie about a new book that's coming. We don't want to give too much away about that.
I have a new book out, and I'll just mention it because it is up on my website, but it hadn't officially been launched yet. But that is called The Clubhouse, and that is a straight-ahead work of fiction, a novel that's set in my Perry County, Missouri, of the imagination. You know, I've added a few things and kind of filtered through, but the story of a young pastor who, the rules of fiction are, you know, you have to have three parts. First, you have to get your character, your main character, up in a tree, and then you throw rocks at him, and then you get him down out of the tree. Every work of fiction has three parts, but that's The Clubhouse, and there's some elements of magical realism, but again, I don't want to give too much away, but Rod and I are going to talk about my book on creation, because
we've
it just got got reviewed in Logia by the eminent Missouri Synod theologian Paul Zimmerman from Traverse City, Michigan. So I'm looking forward to being back in the studios. And
Logia, in a way, I think for the lay people, Lutheran lay people, Logia is sort of a hidden treasure.
Really is.
I've been subscribing to it, and the work in there is extraordinary.
It really is. It's a must. It's a must read for everyone. And it's great to be on the program, and we've been flooded with calls, haven't we? Of people begging us not to play that baritone horn anymore.
I don't know. Here's Herman. He may have just such a request for you. I don't know. Herman, good morning.
Good morning, good morning, Pastor.
How are you?
As you have retired and are pursuing a publication and music effort, I'm just curious, are you finding it necessary with your things that you're writing or composing in music to have some type of incorporation, a tax accountant, a copyright lawyer, a secretary on the telephone in a cubicle or space in a high-rise building to make that effort go? How involved is this phase of your activity that you've opened in life with your publications of music and the novel and things like that? I'm just kind of curious about that.
Sure. The organizational flowchart of Pergola Press, LLC, is as possible. We have a president, a CEO, a chief operating officer, a chief financial officer. We have a publicity a marketing department. We have a sales department. We have an accounting department, and we also have a general gopher and factotum, you know, if we need a cup of coffee in the front office. And all of those offices that I just described are occupied by me, myself, and I. It's a one-man operation. So it keeps me quite busy juggling all those plates. You know, try to squeeze in a little bit of writing every day, and you know, marketing using the internet and Amazon.com and all the social networks. But Herman, I'll tell you what kind of got me started thinking about this. Number one was the disappointment and frustration I had working with standard publishing companies, because it just takes so long to get something into to print, and the lag time, and so I can get something published quicker. I have more creative control, being my own boss with my own publishing company, and I make a lot more money. Quite frankly, you know, if I run 1,000 copies of a book, the you know, 300-page book, the per book cost comes out to about $3, and you know, I sell it for $20 or $25. You know, that covers the initial investment, which is front loaded, and then some, pretty well, and helps finance the next project. But I came across an essential book by an author named Dan Poynter, P-O-Y-N-T-E-R, Dan Poynter, and it's called The Self-Publishing Manual, and they sell it at Barnes & Noble, or you can get it online. But that book has really been essential, because it takes you step by step through all the different progressive steps needed to, from the initial idea to writing the book to getting it edited and designed and printed and everything. So that's an excellent question, Herman, and not to be overly prolix, but I just want to add that the change in technology, the book industry and the recording industry as we know it are dead or in a dodo bird, as Francis Schaeffer used to say. May he rest in peace. I had privilege of knowing him and attending him on his deathbed. We both lived in Rochester, Minnesota at the time, but that's off the subject. But traditional book publishing, New York Times review of books, Nashville recording industry making records to sell in record stores, the electronic industry has far outstripped all that. So the technology has bypassed the industry in both books and the record industry. That's why you know, I'm the next step for Pergola Press is to get my stuff onto Kindle and to get my records onto electronic downloads.
I see. Well, that's very interesting. As you've retired as a pastor, you still use your God-given talents and in the way of this stewardship to your Lord. And I was just kind of wondering about, you know, your transiting into that phase and some of the background there.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Herman. It's really a thought-provoking question, and I have to add, too, that in the process, in all the work that I do when I'm at a coffeehouse performance, I keep it clean, and so it's, you know, something to bring your family, your wife, too, and try to use humor without any resorting to bad language. But I also find, as it, with my music end of my work, that all my writing has a moral, or is true, whatever is true, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, as St. Paul says in Philippians chapter 4. You know, that's my MO for my writing in general. But the people I meet in, as I circulate in music circles, I've often had the opportunity to testify to the hope that is within me. That is my faith in Jesus Christ, my Savior and Lord. And sometimes it takes 5, or 10 years of having a friendship, a relationship with a person before they'll open up and ask a question about religion or faith. Another time, I was at a coffee house, the Hartford Coffee House down in Tara Grove neighborhood. A young fellow came up to me and said, "Say, could you tell me about Christianity and tell me about Jesus sometime?" This was a young man of Hindu background, nominal Hindu, and I said, "Why, certainly. How about right now?" We sat down on the back step and had a rip it up conversation, and we had a long dialogue for a year, meeting once a week, and I got a lot of stories like that I could tell, just kind of stray dog evangelism, sending out little bits of food here for the beatniks and musicians and people that I happen to know, of whom I am one.
Well, may the Lord bless your witness to Jesus Christ in that manner there to you, Pastor. I thank you very much.
Thanks, and God bless you, Herman.
Thank you, Herman. Good to hear from you today. You read an article last week, Pastor Bowie, where the person was lamenting that, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien incorporate Christian themes in their writing.
They do.
And some things that C.S. Lewis wrote were overtly Christian, but some of his just storytelling.
Right.
Brought these themes in because it was a part of their character, just who they were, and it was exposed in the way their craft was put on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And they were complaining that so much of what passes for Christian literature and Christian allegory is so contrived and so forced. It's as if you have to shove the square peg into the round hole.
Yeah, that's true. John Champlin Gardner, the late, a very fine American novelist, wrote a book called On Moral Fiction.
Right.
And that book was a particular interest to me and inspiration, and it was one of the reasons, I think, that I got kicked out of creative writing school at the University of Arizona. And I went down there for an MFA and had to settle for a PhD, but that's water over the dam. But, I remember talking to a lady in a Christian bookstore in Tucson, Arizona, years ago when I was out there founding a congregation, and she was talking about this new book that had come out by, who's the guy that wrote these supernatural thrillers? I can't remember the name of the guy right now, but she said, for a novel, for fiction, it's not bad, but it just got a hammer. They feel like they hammer away at those themes. Sorry, I bumped the microphone there, flailing around.
You think about Stephen King?
I was a fiction reviewer for World Magazine for a few years, and Ed Veith, my good friend, got me into that, and I really read some. There's a lot of dreadful writing out there among secular writers and among Christian writers as well, but some of the greatest fiction that we have, such as Robinson Crusoe, which is considered kind of the first novel, is profoundly Christian. I was surprised when I finally got around to reading it. But the entire industry today is dominated by people that live on the Upper West Side of New York City, and they've never met anybody in their life that goes to church. But the industry is falling apart, and upstart unknown people like myself can produce records and books on a local level. But I work very hard at my craft, and in the baseball novel I'm working on now, the whole action of the place really takes place on the baseball field, apart from church, in a Christian novel, which does not involve a worship service or a sermon preached from a pulpit, which is what you find in many, if not all, Christian, supposedly Christian novels. I mean,
so you are an author. You've also done commentary reviews of other works.
Yeah.
So what makes a good author a good author?
Imagination. As Shakespeare said, bodies forth the shape of things unknown, gives to airy nothing a local habitation and name. There is the innate talent, the imagination. It helps, I think, I was talking to some of my classmates that I grew up with at Emmanuel Lutheran School in St. Charles, Missouri, and we were agreeing that all of us had report cards that said, student is not working up to his ability, or Freddie could do better if he tried. You know, and I just kind of daydreamed my way through grade school, staring out the window at the pigeons circling around the steeple at Emmanuel Lutheran Church, which is a very high steeple. And it kind of never grew up in that regard. You know, I've grown up and learned how to be responsible and pay the bills and, you know, do things like work hard and so forth. But the part of me that never grew up, the Peter Pan side of me that daydreams, that's where ideas come from. We kind of disengage your rational mind and let your imagination just kind of free flow, and then the craft comes in. The word poetry comes from the Greek word poieo, which means to do or to make, and a poet is therefore a maker or builder of something, of words that has a structure and internal support and conforms to the conventions of good writing, which is true in poetry, short stories, novels, and so forth. Have I answered your question? Blathering on.
No, you have, and it's not a one-dimensional craft.
No, and the thing about that I like about working in larger forms, although really I think my true métier is in hymn writing, because my training and experience is in music, theology, and literature, and hymn writing is the one area where I bring them all three together. It's a great privilege for me to be involved in the Hymn Writers Conference of the LCMS, which is being held later this month. I got to tell you right here, and I'm tremendously excited because I looked at hundreds of submissions, and there are some outstanding hymn writers out there in the Missouri Synod.
Can they compete with the 16th century?
The thing of it is, I was talking with John Vicar the other day and Will Wheaton. I said, who are these people? You know, there's certain people that we expected would turn in hymn texts, people we knew, but there's a whole raft of people we never heard of in our life. We don't know who these people are. Lay people or clergy or what, but just really, really good hymn texts.
Let's go back to the phones. We have some callers who are waiting for me. I'd like to explore someday when you come back.
Oh, okay.
Why we need more hymns. Have you noticed the Lutheran service book? It's chock-a-block full of hymns. Don't we have enough?
Oh, yeah, we need more.
James, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I'm enjoying your talk today. I'd like to ask the pastor, which is his favorite Canterbury tale? Is it the partner or the parson? And what can we today get out of those two portrayals of the clergy that Chaucer had back then?
Yeah.
James, and I'll hang up and listen.
Well, James, when I was writing for Lutheran Forum magazine, Ron Bagnell, the editor, was a good friend of mine. He was a pastor in Trenton, New Jersey, while I was over in the Philadelphia area, and we saw each other quite frequently. And and he wanted me to write more on literary themes. And one of the books or one of the articles that I turned in for Lutheran Forum was called Chaucer's Pastorale. Now, Pastorale, P-A-S-T-O-R-A-L-E. A pastorale is a book of practical theology. And I wrote on the Canterbury Tales and on the Parson's Tale particularly, and the lessons that could be drawn from it as far as, you know, how a good pastor should be and act toward his people, not be domineering, and be, you know, gentle and kind, and gather the flock and lead, you know, bring back the strays and provide them with the food from the Word of God and so forth. So, yeah, the Parson's Tale certainly one of my favorites. But it's like asking me which is my favorite play of Shakespeare's. Now, while I'm on the subject, I'll mention another article that I did called what was the title of it? Redemptive Themes in Shakespeare. And one of the things that I found in studying Shakespeare's plays is a significant Christian undertext. Or subtext, that each of the traditional seven deadly sins, like lust and pride and gluttony and so forth, is illustrated in some way in one or another of Shakespeare's plays. And another thing that surprises me is that there are on-stage resurrections depicted in about six of Shakespeare's plays. For example, a hero, you know, the girl in Much Ado About Nothing, which is Kenneth Branagh production, was such a success a few years ago. Everybody thinks she's dead, and but you know, she makes a virtual a resurrection at the end of that play. There's great writing in the past that we neglect at our peril. And this is what I'm going to tell the people at the Hymn Writers Conference, is to read the poets and also to listen to hillbilly music.
Yeah, I've got to tell you, Pastor, to what you said about being the grade school student over there at Emmanuel. I was the same way, and to this day, it took me a while to get there, but I appreciate being forced to read some of the things like Dante's Inferno,
yeah,
and the Upton Sinclair novels and all those sorts of things.
Sure.
Didn't appreciate it at the time, hated it at the time, ever yeah. so glad they forced me to do it now.
Yeah.
Much like catechism.
Right. But just to piggyback on one thing, you know, I'm not being facetious about hillbilly music, because Harlan Howard, the great country music writer, described country music as three chords and the truth. And as far as expressing something succinctly and that really is true and just grabs you by the throat, folk music, country music, We need to pay attention to that.
We'd need hours to answer this, but whatever happened to country music? It's all kind of popsy. The themes have changed. It's no longer Tammy Wynette. It's now I'm going down to the honky-tonk to pick up whatever, you know, that sort of stuff.
Well, everything sounds like Rascal Flatts.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons, Missouri sent a fellow that I met down in Nashville, spent a long time explaining. This guy was a former member of Dr. Larry Rast's congregation, because Larry was pastor in Nashville area when he was a young fellow and working on his doctorate. But he said that the industry has changed, where that the former independent radio stations are a thing of the past, multinational conglomerates have bought up all the stations, and that's why you can drive from coast to coast and hear the same 15 songs all the way.
It's all formulaic too.
Yeah.
Pastor Emeritus Frederick Bowie, Fritz Bowie. You can find his work at pergolapress.com.
Not formulaic.
And I tell you what, we didn't get Faith on the air. Faith, you hang on. I think Pastor might want to pick up that call off air when we leave here. Thank you, my friend. It's always delightful. It's such a gift you bring to me. I appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Take care. We'll be back tomorrow
with more
Blue.
Listen to the Bible Study Monday through Friday at this same time. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for the Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download archives at kfuo.org. The Bible Study is heard weekdays on KFUO Radio, a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.